Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is Connecting Faith. We're here to connect the, or reconnect the eternal with the everyday, however you want to think about that. And on this Good Friday, it occurs to me that the greatest act of reconnection between the eternal and the everyday is actually what we observe today on Good Friday. The vertical love of God translated horizontally in and through the person of Jesus Christ and his act upon the cross at Calvary. So you want to just consider that for just a moment. The ultimate reconnect between the eternal and the everyday takes place. At least we observe it today on Good Friday. Hopefully you have invested some time today or investing time now in setting aside some holy time, some time for you to consider the sacrifice that God made of himself upon the cross. All right, friends, what we are trying to do here on Connecting Faith is to help you make the connections between what's going on in the world and life around you and to equip you to enter into the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus. And so today that is going to focus on the cross. I mean, hopefully every day we're focusing our energy and attention on the cross of Jesus Christ, but particularly today. So if you want to connect with me, you can do so on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. You can connect with me at reconnectwithcarmen.com. That's where I post blogs and other ministry resources if you are interested in grabbing some of those. So on this Good Friday, I really want to start with a conversation about where everybody went when everything went wrong. Where did everybody go when everything seemingly went so horribly wrong? Now, you and I stand on the post-Easter side of Good Friday, and so we have a perspective on the events of Calvary that those who were experiencing them in real time did not enjoy. And so it appeared to them as if everything had gone horribly wrong, and the Lord whom they were following was being crucified. So I want you to think about for a moment what that experience might have been like. And I want you to consider the experiences of Jesus, when he pours out his heart before the Father in the Garden of Gethsemane. And it is the will of God for him to proceed in this direction toward the cross. I want you to consider, have you ever poured your heart out before God and his good and perfect answer has been no, or not now, or not in that way? Have you ever been betrayed by somebody that you thought was your friend? I mean, the experience of Jesus in relationship to Judas, and then in terms of being abandoned by Peter. Have you ever been falsely accused of something you didn't do? And what is it like to stand condemned before the world for crimes you did not commit? Have you ever felt, utterly abandoned when you really needed somebody standing there by your side? That's actually where Jesus stands on the reality of Good Friday. In Matthew 26, it says this: while Jesus was still, he was still speaking, so that would be Jesus, in the Garden of Gethsemane, Judas, one of the 12, arrived, and with him was a large crowd armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal. You and I both know that he gives him a kiss. They step forward and they seize Jesus to arrest him. And this is when Peter cuts off the ear of the servant of the high priest, and Jesus miraculously heals him. And Jesus says, basically, look, am I leading a rebellion that you've felt like you had to come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I'm with you. I'm in the temple. I'm teaching. You didn't arrest me there. And then he acknowledges that all of this has taken place in order that what the prophets have said might be fulfilled. And then there's this sentence: then all the disciples deserted him and fled. Matthew 26, verse 56. All the disciples deserted him and fled. Jesus stands alone in the midst of a hateful mob of bullies. Judas has betrayed him. The other disciples have fled from him. Angry hands now hold him fast. There's no compassion in the eyes of those who have gathered to accuse and condemn and ultimately crucify him. And so from all outward appearances, God has literally lost control of the situation. It certainly appears as if the devil is winning. It certainly appears as if Jesus is not who the disciples had come to believe him to be. I mean, Jesus was supposed to change everything. Jesus is supposed to be the king in the line of David. Jesus is supposed to be the Messiah, the liberator, like Moses. Jesus was supposed to be, you know, the Son of God who gave the Romans what for and set God's people free. You and I can understand how human feelings or how human beings who were facing what we now call the Stations of the Cross, when they were facing those events on that very first Good Friday, we can understand how they might have thought that it was anything but good. You and I can understand how the human beings experiencing, again, what we call the Stations of the Cross, we can understand how horrible they felt about what was going on, how confused, how bewildered they would have been. How could everything have gone so horribly wrong? And yet you and I know that in all of that, what God accomplishes is a righteousness that the world would otherwise never know. Now, pause for just a moment and recognize that Jesus had told them all of this was going to happen. We call them the passion predictions. They actually happen over and over and over again. Mark 8:31, Mark 9:31, Mark 10:32 to 34. Over and over and over again, Jesus had told them in advance exactly what was going to happen. He began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering, be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said to them, the Son of Man is being betrayed into human hands. They're going to kill him, and 3 days later he's going to rise again. He took the 12 aside, and he said, look, we're going to Jerusalem. The Son of Man is going to be handed over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they're going to condemn him to death. They're going to hand him over to the Gentiles. They're going to mock him, spit on him, flog him, kill him, and after 3 days he will rise again. They had been told, which reminds me all the times that I have been told. Like, how many times do you have to be told? Well, it takes some of us a lot of times to learn. And so I think that's one of the reasons that it's important to sort of revisit the rhythm of this journey to Jerusalem, revisit the rhythm of going into the upper room and experiencing the events of the Last Supper. It's important for us to revisit the foot washing. It's important for us to revisit Jesus' experience in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's important for us to revisit Jesus saying to the Father, not my will, but thine be done. It's important for us to travel again to the foot of the cross and to everything, every event in the life of Jesus that leads up to his crucifixion on our behalf. And so my encouragement to you today is to recognize the long journey that Jesus had been on at this point. And for those of us who just make haste to the foot of the cross on Good Friday, having not fully prepared ourselves over the course of not only Holy Week, but maybe the season of Lent, maybe over a much longer period of discipleship, in which we recognize that this walking with Jesus is not just the glory of Resurrection Sunday. It's not just the glory of Easter. It is actually coming to the cross and dealing with Jesus at the cross. Jesus deals with our sin on the cross, but we need to deal with Jesus at the cross, each and every one of us. And so when we begin to answer the question, where did all of the disciples go when everything went horribly wrong, the answer to that question is actually answered throughout the Gospels, where we actually do find out where the disciples ran to and where they hid and what they were doing. And we certainly know that that 3 days later they were together in the upper room. And so that's where we find them on Sunday morning. But there's no one to be found while he is upon the cross. We do know that John was there at the foot of the cross because it is into John's care that Jesus commends his own precious mom. And so I thought today I would actually bring my precious mom onto the program and have a conversation with her about the generational legacy of faith in our family. Her 80th birthday happens to be tomorrow, so I thought this would be an opportunity for us to talk about faith generation to generation. This is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, and I'll be right back. Welcome back. You are listening to Connecting Faith on this Good Friday. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. We find ourselves standing at the foot of the cross. And as I mentioned just before the break, one of the things that happens is that Jesus commends his own precious mother to the care of his disciple, John. And so on this Good Friday, and in recognition of the fact that tomorrow is her 80th birthday, I wanted to bring my own precious mom on to Connecting Faith and share her with you. So, Mom, Ruth Ann Fowler-Melzer, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, thanks, Carmen. It's great to be with you.
Well, it's so wonderful to have you on. And what folks do not know about you is that in addition to, I don't know, having the blame or thanks in the world for being my mom, you're also my sister's mom, Tiana. But you're an author and quite accomplished professional in your own right. And so there's probably lots of people listening right now who would recognize you by your by my maiden name, would recognize you as Ruth Ann Fowler and the host of, wow, I don't know, did Can Do Clinic run for like 14 years on PBS in the Tampa area?
Correct. Can Do Clinic.
Right, and then you're also the author of The Significant Difference, You, The Significant Difference. So let's start there, and let's talk about what it means for an individual to live into the uniqueness of who they are as a significant difference maker.
Well, I guess, number one, we have to accept everything in the present because that's all you can do anything about is today, and then think about tomorrow. And so if you can take advantage of every single thing about you that makes you really special and respect the fact that everybody that even catches a glimpse of you, let alone hears your voice, you do make a difference to them. And that difference, of course, is based on all of them, where they are too. But it's very, very important that we understand that every single person is very special and has been given wonderful gifts by God. I call it God's part of the DNA that tells us who we are, what we are, what our values are, what actually our legacy is going to be. He knows exactly what's going to happen to us every day and our purpose in life. So that's making a significant difference is celebrate who and what you are every day to the fullest extent, and you will make a difference.
And so people are listening to this and they're thinking to themselves, so this is the emotional and psychological environment in which a person like Carmen is raised. And so, you know, from very early on in my life, I recall you reinforcing, actually articulating and then reinforcing these very same ideas over and over and over again. And so, you know, I'm a person who had the luxury of growing up with you as my mom, but not everybody has the luxury of having a mom like you. And so let's just let you mother some people here for a minute. Why don't you just tell our listeners, you know, why you perceive them to be precious?
Well, we know that every single person is very, very unique, rare, valuable. And those qualities dictate your values, your goals, your standards, your beliefs. And those things actually indicate and tell who and what you are. And the thing that we as Christians know that a lot of people don't know is we can say who and what we are based on our special, unique talents, gifts, and abilities. And God is the one that tells us where is there. There is a there, and where is the there? And we know that. And so, therefore, we don't wander around wondering every day what we're supposed to be doing. We have special direction and purpose and a map of what we're supposed to be doing in life. And I'm just a firm believer that we effectively specialize in giving and reaching out to other people in lots and lots and lots of ways. And most of the time, we don't really know what we're giving out. We just do our very best that we possibly can, knowing that somebody's going to reach on to that in some way, and hopefully it's very positive for their tomorrows, because we can do nothing about yesterday. You know, one of my famous all the these years is look back but don't stare. You can't do a thing about yesterday, but we can focus on today and tomorrow and celebrate who and what we are. And so if you always look for the possible, positive, possible future rather than yesterday and focus on those rare value gifts that have been given to you, you will make a difference.
So, folks, you are hearing the voice of Ruth Ann Fowler Melzer. She is my precious mom. She wrote a book called You, the Significant Difference. But she also wrote a couple of lives, and those lives have names as well, Tiana and Carmen. Mom, I definitely think that one of the greatest things about you is that you always acknowledge that the greatest thing about you isn't you. And so I think that there's a humility about you that's not a false humility. It's a genuine humility, and I really feel like it's the legacy of Grandma lived out in you in very particular ways. And so one of the things that you have talked about is that we are who we are when we were who we were when, or something like that. And so talk about who you are in terms of the daughter of Robina, and then obviously the mother of others.
Right. Well, I am what I was when is how you start everything. I am what I was when I was born to my mother, Robina Ringwald Benefiel, and in that particular cultural setting of extremely, extremely rural southern Indiana, and then everything that happened after that. You know, I am what I was when I went to kindergarten, and that was the first time I ever knew that I was so different when the kindergarten teacher said, "You're big, you'll sit in the back." I never knew I was tall until then. And so if we think of every day, I am what I was when this happened to me, whatever it is, and then think about the positives that come out of it. And so my mother was very, very, very positive person, and had to be to get through every single day of she and my dad's lives. And they celebrated the blessings every day and just kind of forgot that there were trials and tribulations. And my favorite story about her is when she got cancer, and I flew to be with her, and we went to see the doctor, and he said, "Yes, we will start chemo." And my mother said, "Well, will I lose my hair?" And the doctor said, "Oh, probably not. Lots of people don't lose their hair." And my mother said, "Oh, well, gee, I never did have a good head of hair. If I had a chance to grow it in again, it'd probably come in better. And that's the way she looked at life, totally. It didn't matter what didn't happen. It happened. It mattered to her what could be or what could happen. And so I am what I was when I heard those lines from her. And she was obviously a very, very firm believer in God and the Christian life and the Christian way, and was so thankful for the blessings of her children. And I've always said that no matter how long my resume is, no matter what people pick out of it, the most important valuable accomplishment I have in my life are my two wonderful professional daughters who are very giving and caring. That's what life's about, is giving and caring and reaching out.
All right, friends, so you are hearing my mom, Ruth Ann Fowler Melzer, and we're just having a visit here on this Good Friday in anticipation of not only the events of Easter weekend, but in anticipation of my mom's 80th birthday. So let me say happy birthday to you today. And that means I must be turning 50 if you're turning 80. So there's that. So one of the things about Grandma Benefield that I want to be sure that we communicate today, because I really feel like I am very much who I am because of who she was. And I still live, Mom, every day, you know, seeking to be a Christian of whom Grandma would be proud. And one of the things that I celebrate and remember about her is that she would just hum the old rugged cross like all the time. And so today on Good Friday, maybe just share with us one memory of Grandma in terms of like what we know she's doing now.
Well, I'm sure she's still trying to play the piano better and play all those hymns that she loved. And she played those hymns to you and Tiana as we would come and visit. She would sit at the piano and she would play and sing to you girls, and loved all of those old wonderful hymns. And the old Rugged Cross was, of course, mm-hmm. one of her favorites. But, the one about, you know, I could come to the garden alone, or Blessed Assurance, Jesus is mine. I mean, all of those that.
All right, Mom, we got to leave it right there. I love
okay.
you. Happy birthday. And happy Easter. All right, friends, when we come back, I'm going to be talking with Fernando Ortega and about his project, which we're calling The Crucifixion of Jesus. And it is a composition of songs and readings related to Good Friday, and it's a conversation that you don't want to miss. Fernando Ortega with me just in a minute. This is Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge.
Stricken, smitten, and afflicted, see him dying on the tree. 'Tis the Christ by man rejected, yes, my soul, 'tis he, 'tis he. 'Tis the long-expected prophet, David's son, yet David's Lord. By his Son God now has spoken, 'tis the true and faithful word.
Friends, that melodic voice and that truthful proclamation is coming from Fernando Ortega, one of Christian music's most respected composers. And we are privileged to have him with us here on Connecting Faith to talk about this project, this record, The Crucifixion of Jesus. It includes not only tracks like the one that you just heard, but also portions of spoken word, where Fernando is reading direct excerpts from Scripture or other excerpted material. I love the one from Holy Living, by the way. And it's woven together in such a way that it's a companion for us during Holy Week. It takes us from the events of Palm Sunday to Calvary, as you just heard in that particular song. So, Fernando, welcome again to Connecting Faith. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'm trying to imagine, singing about the things about which you're singing and singing it in the voice of Jesus, and the experience, particularly in terms of what happens on the cross. So, oh, great love, now crucified. I want you to talk about the cross and what it means to you and why you put together a project to help people get there.
I guess, answer that by saying that after being a Christian all my life, really, but I mean, I really coming to faith when I was around 14, but being in the church before that, that I, the biggest lesson that I keep coming back to is the beginning place is a place that is largely negative. The poor in spirit, the way the Beatitudes start, the way that we approach God on our knees and with our head bowed and acknowledging our sin. And a lot of people, when I was recording this record and putting those images together of Christ on the cross and being tortured and all those, they're beautiful paintings, by the way, but people would say, why would you want to camp out on this for so long? At least put one song about the resurrection at the end of the record so it won't be so hopeless. But really, it's the starting place. The gospel begins there. Death to ourselves, death to sin, and then Christ raising us to new life. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to camp out on this subject and make a full record about it. I thought it would be super challenging, and it was. But, the best place to start.
So the readings are as powerful as the music. And I don't want people to miss that this is a project that's woven together. It has 11 tracks that are sung, but it has 6 tracks that are spoken. And that weaving together is a very powerful experience in terms of a worship rhythm. And so I really appreciated that in listening to this. And yet, Psalm 22 is not something you read. It's something you sing. And that was, I will just tell you, that might have been, like, it's probably wrong to say it was my favorite track because it seems wrong to have that be a favorite. But Psalm 22, in the way it's presented here in this project, it took me to my knees. And I just want you to know that. I want you to know the kind of ministry that that this has for individuals. And you and I both know that, faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word of God. And so when you are singing the scripture, I'll just tell you that that might have been the most impactful part of this project to me.
That's interesting that you say that. That song came about last year, last Good Friday. My pastor, who's very spontaneous, he's a young fellow, and just before the service, maybe a few hours before, he said, when we get to that psalm, instead of reading it, can you just chant it? So I had to come up with music, within a couple of hours. And so I did. And that night, I think everybody came up and said the same thing that you just said. That was the most powerful part. And I did it on that night without an instrument accompanying me. It was just completely a cappella. And on this record, it's the strings vibrating on a piano. I hit the chords, but we didn't record the strike of the keys. We just recorded the aftermath. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of looped it together to make it this feel of intense emotion. So I'm really glad to hear you say what you said.
All right, friends. So I actually had the opportunity to record this conversation earlier with Fernando. And so today, as we share this on Good Friday, what we are experiencing on this day as we stand at the foot of the cross is literally the crucifixion of Jesus. And so in his songs and in the readings related to the songs, we actually get to journey together to the experience of the cross. And so I want you to listen now to one of the readings from the Crucifixion of Jesus project. Again, this is Fernando Ortega.
A reading from the book of Matthew. As they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. They came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. There they offered Jesus wine to drink, mixed with gall, but after tasting it, he refused to drink it. When they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots, and sitting down, they kept watch over him there. Above his head, they placed the written charge against him: "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Two robbers were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" In the same way, the robbers who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him.
All right, friends, when we consider what Jesus endured on our behalf, when we actually consider the cross, I don't know about you, but I am made acutely aware of my desperate need for a Savior. I'm aware of not only my brokenness, but sometimes my emptiness toward the things of God. I'm aware of the ways in which I have mocked Christ. I'm aware of the ways in which I have failed to fully appreciate the sacrifice that God has made that I might live in a restored relationship with him through my Savior, Jesus. And so as we consider the cross today, one of the portions of this project that Fernando Ortega embarked upon is just called Psalm 22. And as he shares it, I just want you to imagine the Lord and Savior, Jesus the Christ, in these words.
My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me? Far from the words of my groaning. Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer. I cry by night, but I find no rest.
Friends, I'd like for you to consider what Christ endured on our behalf. Indeed, friends, as we stand at the foot of the cross, on this most important and darkest of days, you and I have the privilege of knowing what happens on Sunday. We have the privilege of knowing that that indeed Jesus Christ was not forsaken by the Father, but raised to newness of life, in order that we too, who would die with Christ, would be raised with him in glory. And so, not seeking to get ahead of the Good Friday story, and not seeking to run too swiftly from the cross to the empty tomb, I also want us to be people who are making the hope of the cross and what is offered there in Jesus made known to others. And so lift up your drooping eyes and strengthen your sometimes weak knees, in order that we might be people who walk by faith in these days, even as we find ourselves at the foot of the cross of our Savior. All right, friends, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be previewing a program that is going to air here tomorrow night. And it's called Unlocking the Bible. And so we are going to examine together the experience of Judas on this day. Friends, this is Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. Hey friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. On this Good Friday, I'm taking a little bit more of a contemplative approach to the program. As you enter into the world that God so loves, there are folks who, you know, frankly are not attracted to the cross and don't understand what we as Christians are doing on this day. Why is it indeed that Good Friday is considered good when it is such a dark day? Well, you and I know that it is because what is accomplished on Good Friday is utterly a reversal of fortunes. The heir of all things, Jesus the Christ, the Son of the living God, who stands to inherit the kingdom of heaven, instead gives up his life in order that those who are separated from God might be restored in a relationship with him, that God's redemptive plan for all of human history might actually take root in the hearts and lives of people like you and me. And so what is offered at the cross is nothing short of salvation from sin and death, and also a liberation unto newness of life. Judas was probably the first person that we can point to and say he so hated the idea that that God would redeem people who didn't deserve to be redeemed, that he was willing to betray the Son of God unto death. And so we revisit Judas's story as a part of a project that is going to air here tomorrow night, and it is entitled Unlocking the Bible. It's a radio special. It's going to air tomorrow night, March the 31st, from 7 to 9 p.m., and if you are interested in having a copy of the book related to this program, Heaven So Near, So Far, you can send an email to connectingfaith@myfaithradio.com, connectingfaith@myfaithradio.com. We'll collect the names and do a drawing after Easter and send that out. So again, this is a portion of a program that's going to air tomorrow night. The entire program is called Unlocking the Bible, and it'll be on from 7 to 9 on March the 31st. Let's listen together.
My time in the upper room was well spent because now I had all the information I needed to fulfill my promise to the priests. I had learned that after the supper, Jesus would go to a garden outside the city. I knew the place well because Jesus had often met with us there. It was a quiet place at any time of day, but at night it would be completely deserted. Armed with the knowledge of where Jesus would soon be, I made my way across the city to the high priest's palace. Again, it was Malchus who opened the door. "Round up the men," I said. My plan was meticulous. I thought of everything. If the disciples resisted Jesus' arrest, we were armed with swords and clubs. If Jesus chose to hide in the garden, we had torches and lanterns and would search until we found him. Our force was overwhelming in numbers and strength, and without the presence of the crowd to protect him, I was certain that our mission would end in success. When everyone was gathered, Malchus called the group to order. He reminded them of the importance of our mission, and then invited me to give instructions. "We are heading to the Garden of Gethsemane," I said. "Jesus will be there with his 11 disciples. Apart from them, the place should be deserted." I knew that if I relied on pointing to Jesus in the darkness, there would be room for confusion, especially if the disciples started running in different directions, so I settled on a sign that could not be mistaken. "When we arrive in the garden, I will identify him with a kiss," I said. A nod and grunt of approval went around the group. "When I kiss him," I continued, "you must arrest him immediately. No delays. And when you seize him, make sure that you hold him securely. Whatever you do, don't underestimate him. I have seen him still a storm and even raise the dead." Some of the Roman soldiers at the back seemed to find this amusing. Here we were, a great crowd, fully armed, setting out on a mission to arrest one man who had the support of no more than 11 friends. The size of the force and the intensity of my instructions seemed ludicrous to the professionals, who must have wondered why we were mounting what seemed like a major operation to accomplish something so apparently simple. But then, they didn't know Jesus. With our preparations complete, we set out. Jew and Gentile united together, the power of religion and the power of the state moving as one with the objective of arresting and binding Jesus. It was an overwhelming force, and I was leading them. Me, Judas Iscariot, the one who was always named last among the disciples. Now I was at the front, striding out with a vast armed force behind me, all of them following my lead. My moment had finally come. When we arrived at Gethsemane, I could see the disciples scattered across the garden. It looked to me as if they had been sleeping and were still in the process of getting to their feet. What took me by surprise was that Jesus came striding toward us. I had thought that I would have to seek him out, but instead, he stepped forward resolutely from the trees as if to confront us. "Whom do you seek?" he demanded. His question was addressed to Malchus. This was not what I had expected. I had told the priests that I would go up to Jesus and kiss him, but Jesus had seized the initiative, and now I was unsure of how to proceed. Malchus responded to the question, "Whom do we seek?" "Jesus of Nazareth," he said. What happened next was quite extraordinary and wholly unexpected. Jesus said, "I am he." As he said this, we were overwhelmed by a blinding flash of light. It was so intense that our entire army, the priests, Pharisees, elders, and Roman soldiers, along with Malchus and myself, collapsed on the ground as if we had all been struck by a bolt of lightning. I felt rather foolish lying there in the dust, and looking up could see the surprise of the disciples. It must have been quite a sight. Hundreds of armed men with swords, clubs, lanterns, and torches, all falling backward and landing on top of each other on the ground. After a few moments, I got up and brushed the dust from my clothing. Behind me, the temple guards picked up their torches, lanterns, swords, and clubs, and behind them, the Roman cohort slowly got to their feet. None of them were laughing now. When we were all back on our feet, Jesus repeated his question, "Whom do you seek?" Somewhat shaken, Malchus replied as he had before, "Jesus of Nazareth." "I told you that I am he," Jesus answered. The plan that called for me to identify Jesus with a kiss now seemed completely unnecessary. But without knowing what else to do, I went ahead anyway. "Greetings, Rabbi," I said as I moved toward him. Before I could reach him, he responded with a question that still haunts me. "Judas, would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss?" Even in the garden, as I was about to betray him, Jesus was reaching out to me in love. It was as if he were saying, "Do you really want to do this, Judas?" I hesitated for a moment, but I had passed the point of no return. Ignoring his last plea, I took that final step forward and kissed him. That kiss was the most futile thing I ever did. I had thought of it as the centerpiece of my elaborate plan, but it accomplished nothing except to confirm my defection from being a follower of Jesus. The armed force was equally futile. I had brought an army of several hundred men, but in truth a single arresting officer would have been enough. Turning to the priests, elders, and Pharisees, Jesus said, "Have you come out as against a robber, with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But let the scriptures be fulfilled." With this, Jesus stepped forward, presenting his wrists so they could bind him. And as he did, the disciples ran off into the night. I recalled how Jesus had said, "No one takes my life from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again." Jesus was not arrested as a helpless victim. He gave himself willingly into the hands of his enemies. The group I had been leading took Jesus to the high priest's palace. But once they had their man, they had no further use for me. And since the disciples had already fled, I was left alone in the garden.
One of the things that we recognize about Good Friday, friends, is that darkness falls. And darkness certainly fell on the life of Judas. I've got a friend named Betty, and many years ago, Betty's son died. Betty is a woman of faith, a follower of Jesus, but I will tell you that when the darkness of death fell across her home, she was plunged into a deep suffering that was really hard to express. She asked many questions that have yet to be answered. She had doubts. She had fears. But she also knew that Good Friday is not the end of the story. She knew that Sunday comes. She knows that there is a third day, that there is hope, that light shines in the darkness, and that the darkness will never ultimately overcome it. But here's the choice that Betty and you and I have to make. We have to get up in the dark. And so for the next 2 days, let us be people who get up in the dark, awaiting the one who rises from death to newness of life, and therefore makes life possible. Life worth living here and now, and life worth living forevermore. Indeed, indeed, this life is worth the living because he lives. Friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. On this Good Friday, may you spend some time at the foot of the cross, and then may you find yourself on Sunday morning worshiping at the empty tomb. I will see you right back here on Resurrection Monday. Have a great weekend, and God bless.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Connecting Faith. These conversations are available because of listener support. Thanks for making a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To catch future editions of Connecting Faith, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to connect the eternal with the everyday through Connecting Faith.